Everybody, to the latest edition of Space Force, the motion picture continues. I'm Jason Tondro.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Stuart Smith.
And we're picking up where we left off last week in our analysis of Star Trek: The Motion Picture. Last week we talked about kind of the historical context for this film, that it came out in the era of the Voyager probe and the Jupiter Pictures. That Star Trek, we talked about all of its evolution between the original series all the way to the motion picture with things called, is it called Planet of the Titans? Is that right, Jim?
Yeah, Planet of the Titans was one, and the God Machine was the
God, that's right, the God thing. And
the God thing, that's right.
And then the phase two, and how all of that kind of rolled into the motion picture. And we spent a lot of time talking about kind of how the script did or did not kind of come together for that film. And a lot of the common perception of the film, which is that it's generally perceived as kind of too slow, and it's compared to films like Star Wars, when maybe it's more like Close Encounters of the third kind, and if you're looking for a film touchstone. But we wanted to get back on to the show, specifically talking about, now that we've talked about all the backstory, like the actual plot of the movie itself and the scenes and the characters actually in the film. Let's start with the characters, like the two new people, Decker and Ilya.
Redshirt 1 and Redshirt 2.
Say again?
Redshirt 1 and Redshirt 2.
Yeah, and we mentioned this last week that it's you just know at the climactic moment when you've got Spock, Kirk, and McCoy, and then this new guy, like, who's going to die, right? Who's going to sacrifice themselves? And it's the NPC. As everyone knows, I have to analyze every game, every film in terms of its gaming, right? Like, everything is a game model in my head. And I got so pissed at all of the times that Kirk took over for other characters doing their job in this movie. Like, there's this scene with Yeoman Rand transporting people.
Yeah.
And Kirk comes in and he takes over the transporter. I don't think Rand has any lines in this movie. She appears in the transporter room. She never speaks.
I don't think he speaks. I think she gets name checked. And I think that's
yeah.
What she
knows, yeah, yeah, I think that's the extent of it. If she gets a line of dialogue, it's a perfunctory exposition, what's going on.
I just watched it. She doesn't say anything. And similar things happen. Like, Kirk, he takes over the communication console at one point. Like, he has to come in and just take over everybody's job. If this is a role player group, he's the worst player ever. He's the guy that wants to take over everybody else's job on the bridge crew. But I digress. Let's get back to the new people. Decker was a prototype for the character of Riker, and he was in the phase two script. Is that right?
Yeah, he was developed for the TV show.
Okay.
Like, he was developed to be someone, like, because at this point, Roddenberry writes the motion picture novelization. And I bring this up because Roddenberry starts talking about new humans in the motion picture novelization. New humans. And the new humans is what he's going to move forward with Next Generation. So he has these ideas already percolating in his head that people are going to perfect themselves in the 100 years.
Uh-huh.
That separate Kirk and Picard. Like, he hasn't nailed it down, but he has these ideas in his head. And so Riker or Decker is supposed to be one of these new evolved humans. That's why he has the relationship with the sexually evolved Ilea. Because he's mature enough and he's calm and composed enough that he can handle that, as opposed to Kirk, who is very baseline.
Interesting.
And the novel actually has Kirk talking about in the Force Wilson new humans and how Starfleet seems to be relying on the gun tone, like his type of people. It's real. It's a real sci-fi concept that's never brought into Trek proper.
It reminds me a little bit of Khan, frankly. This idea that we were genetically engineering them. But that must be like the bad version of doing this, right? Like, if you have to genetically engineer an advanced human, that's bad. But if they naturally evolve towards being a better kind of human, that's good.
Through social engineering, I guess, because that's sort of like the construct of the way it's described in the novelization is it's explained through like social programs and social engineering.
It's a very Asimovian foundation idea.
Yeah.
Sounds like the X-Men. Sounds like
nowadays
we're Homo Superior. We are the X-Men.
Yeah. So, but that is a long-standing sci-fi trope. So it makes sense that it appears in the X-Men, which is basically a sci-fi comic, right? Like it's at its roots, right? Like we're all mutants. We're all products of radiation. You know, it kind of has that sci-fi roots to it. But Decker, there was a Decker. Commodore Decker in the original series?
Yeah, in the episode called The Doomsday Machine.
Oh, yeah, right, the Planet Eater.
Yeah, he's the one who goes insane and is like, I'm going to ram this ship down their throat.
So this Decker is his son?
Yes.
Okay.
And there was a cadet Decker shout-out on Discovery in the episode Into the Fullest I Go.
Which is presumably Commodore Decker.
Well, presumably it's this guy. Because remember, Discovery is only 10 years before.
Yes.
And this guy has to become a captain in that time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay.
And the motion picture only takes place 2 years after Colt's time.
Two and a half, right?
Two and a half, yeah. Even though we look at the actors and we can tell that two and a half.
No, it's got to be more than five. Okay, wait. It's more than two and a half because there were only three seasons of the show, but the mission was 5 years.
Okay, so the way that gets explained.
Okay.
So the episode Where No Man Has Gone Before with Gary Mitchell, the second pilot,
yep,
is a year removed from the bulk of the show.
Okay.
And then the bulk of the show takes place in the last 3 years of his mission.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So and then they sort of fold in the animated series for the last two seasons.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Folded into like years 4 and 5. And that's sort of how they explain Cook's whole mission.
Interesting.
Yeah.
There's a very cool Easter egg in a Peter David Q novel that actually has the Gary Mitchell episode be a parallel universe because they have a different middle name for Kirk on his gravestone.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I think is rather cool. And considering it's got Q and Tremaine in it, it's a good way of having all these multiple timelines all tied together as well. But yeah,
isn't that the book where they established that there was only like one living Jack Crusher and he's an asshole?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
Like, the universe has just purged themselves of Jack Crusher, except there's this one guy, and he's alive because Wesley's dead.
It's really good.
All right, so. So what do we talked a little bit last week about Decker and Kirk's relationship, that Kirk comes on to the Enterprise and steals the ship, basically. And Decker's like, you're not sorry a bit. And this, to me, set up what would have been a great character arc that the show kind of never follows through on. That Kirk never really comes to grips with the fact that Decker was right, that Kirk himself was in the wrong. Now, it worked out, because if Decker had been commander of the Enterprise, it's quite likely they would never have succeeded in the mission and the Earth would be destroyed. But Kirk never has his humble moment where he acknowledges, as he does at the end of Star Trek II, I never had to face the no-win scenario, right? Like that kind of self-examination moment is missing from this picture. And the closest that we get is a kind of moments of camaraderie between Kirk and Decker. The most obvious example to me, I think, is near the end when Kirk says, my bluff has been called, and Decker plays up on the metaphor and says, well, and our hand's pretty weak. And that's kind of a Captain XO moment where they're bonding over their shared gambling metaphor, you know, and they're getting along better than they have any of the rest of the time in the picture.
This is why Phase 2 is such a shame that Phase 2 didn't happen. Because if these two characters were introduced in Phase 2 and we had at least a season of these two characters, new characters in it,
the
motion picture would have been so much better.
Yeah.
You introduced these characters like an hour and a half beforehand and they don't, and you go, okay, but you know, whatever. But if that plot line had been all the way through the first season, and then they made a motion picture, and then they, oh my god, they killed the two new characters off after a season.
Yeah.
That would have been excellent. I really regret the fact that we only see those characters once, and that's it.
Yeah, that would have been really gutsy to have them as the stars of the first season and then kill them off. Yeah.
I mean, even to have, I mean, obviously, even if you've got Kirk and Spock and McCoy running around, even if you kind of played on the idea that, you know, Kirk is on the ship or whatever, but it's just, I just think the gravitas of having them be around for a lot longer would make me better. Yeah.
And then you have to remember, this is the pilot for Phase 2.
Well, this was
like, even, so the resolution of Ilea and Deco doesn't happen in whatever the original script manifest was, whatever that original ending is that we don't have, because they did this ending to get rid of the new people.
Yes, and that's what just seems so strange. It's like this is episode one, the two part effectively. It's like what?
Yeah. And we can't talk about Deco without talking about Ilea, so we'll sort of lump them all in together. Ilea, I just got finished watching the director's cut. And Ilea's sort of empathic healing abilities, or at least her, maybe she only deadens the pain. Like, so that this happens on the bridge. Like, they have the probe arrives, Vitra's probe arrives on the bridge. It electrocutes Chekov, and Ilea immediately runs up from her desk. And you talked about this last week, but I hadn't seen the director's cut, so it was gone. She runs up from her station. She runs over to him. And then a moment later, as Chapel arrives, we see her sort of put – it's very interesting how she does it, because it's very different than Spock, who's the only other person we've seen do, like, touchy psychic shit, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Spock is, like, very delicately, okay, I got to put my fingers in exactly the right spot. Ilea, like, sort of very forcefully pushes both of her arms together onto Chekov's shoulder, and she sort of has this trance thing. And the pain vanishes, and Chekov is the wound still has to be treated, but he's not in pain.
Yeah.
And this becomes Troy's empathic, not telepathy.
Mm-hmm. But they never, like, Troy never. I don't want this to be the 2 hour long bashing of Deanna Troy, because this is very easy too. It's low hanging fruit when it comes to Star Trek. But Troy never makes manifest her power in such a direct way.
Yeah.
Like, Ilea gets this moment. She gets to actually heal someone, or at least maybe not heal them, but soothe them long enough for Dr. Chapel to arrive and take care of it. But Deanna never actually has that moment with her powers.
And she can't do that. She can.
All receptive, isn't it, from Troy, it seems to be.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be any kind of, you know, psychic linky. From her way out, it seems to be coming back.
But like Troy, I mean, like Ilea, Troy was always, well, for the first few seasons at least, was kind of a sex object on the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Until that famous scene where the temporary captain orders her to change her uniform. What was the episode where, like, the
Chain of Command, and that's season 6.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's pretty great. Like, I love that. Jellico, that was his name.
Yeah, Jellico. Jellico, played by Ronnie Fox.
Yeah. And he's an ass, and we don't like him, but it turns out that he's actually pretty good at his job.
He's great at his job. Like, if you watch the episode and you ignore Riker as a human being, like, you ignore your love of Riker, and you're like, okay, Riker was kind of in the wrong. The whole episode, like the whole two episodes, even when Jellico comes to him and is like, hey, I need you to fly the mission. And he's like, so ask me. I mean, Michael, I love you, Michael, but fuck you. You have no more high ground here.
But Jellico tells Troy, he's like, I like all my officers to wear regulation uniforms. And at that point forward, she's, you know, zipped up. So much for the diving V collar, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so...
She was that afraid that he would come back. She's like, okay, for the rest of my life, I am wearing my uniform.
Yeah.
If I'm off duty.
Well, so what do we think about Decker and Ilea as characters, both in this picture and their impact on Star Trek moving forward?
Why don't you take that, Abe?
I just think they didn't get enough. They don't get. They haven't got a legacy as such. That's the thing. It's literally just like one and done. That's it. Job done. They are there purely for the story. There's nothing else to link them to it. It's they're quite cool characters in relation to you see them as proto Troy and Riker, and I find Deckard to be a bit of an ass. He seems to be. It's like, okay, this guy's the admiral. Just deal with it. You know, it seems to be very argumentative and kind of like, okay, you know, just get on with it. But it's, you know, the way they react to other crew members and stuff, it's fine. It's quite good they get to be the focus of the actual movie as well. The whole thing between those two is actually a key part of the actual thing, to get the idea that they can actually make the probe start remembering things. And that's good. As a lasting thing, yeah, I don't see him as being like a key thing as the characters themselves. The ideas, maybe things are carried over to other people, but the actual characters, like, yeah, you know, by Star Trek VI, everyone's going, "Who's Aaliyah?" Nobody would really remember, kind of thing.
It would be interesting to imagine what Star Trek would have looked like if Decker and Aaliyah had not died in this movie and had become recurring characters. But instead, they're like. They're like the Julius Caesar to Hamlet. Like, Shakespeare drafts a lot of the ideas that would show up in Hamlet later, appear first in kind of rough draft form in Julius Caesar. Everybody forgets that there's a ghost in Julius Caesar, right? Like, there's and Decker is he's the Julius Caesar to Riker's Hamlet. And it's kind of, I understand how a writing process works. Like, they come up with a cool character later on and we get Riker, and that's great. But it is a bit of a shame.
So we don't even get a true version of Aaliyah all the way through. We get a pro version of Aaliyah for 90% of the movie as well. So it's not even like her real, like, right. She doesn't give reactions. She's just literally just, you know, she's proto Data effectively. It's like, just stands there, nods, points at things, busts through walls, job done.
I remember Jeremy Renner complaining about Avengers because he spends 3/4 of the first movie mind controlled into a bad guy. And he's like, "This sucks. Like, I I did not sign on to the superhero movie so that I could be mind controlled for most of it." And that's part of the reason why he got more screen time in the films that followed. That's Aaliyah's problem in this one, right? She gets introduced as this big, and it's like, and presenting this brand new actress, right? Who gets like a few scenes, and then she's a robot for the rest of the movie.
That's what I find weird, because they did make a big fact of her appearing, and yes, she's a star, but it's not like, hey, this is a new character we're going to see in the next, you know, if we make 7 of these movies, this is going to be the character you're going to be loving. Yeah, it's weird. Very strange.
But I agree with your point from last week that it was very gutsy to have her bald. Not a lot of actors would have agreed to let that happen, like, especially today. Like, but they did it, and it was, and we talked about the surprise factor there, that she didn't know that was going to happen, and that she was famous for her beautiful hair, and it was a bit of some trauma there. It works in the movie. That doesn't excuse it, but it worked. Jim?
Well, Aid sort of summed it up. I mean, they're not really characters. They're plot tools. Like, Deco is hailed to show that Kulk is out of touch.
Okay.
Deco is hailed to be Kulk's foil. Like, not a villain, because there's really not a villain in this movie. I mean, there is a giant cloud thing, but it's not villainous. It's not evil. It's just trying to perform its mission. So Deckel fills that role of pointing out Kulk's flaws. He does so in a way that, like, McCoy does that. Like, that's McCoy's job.
Yep.
He does it well in the movie.
Yeah,
he's always templed with the fact that McCoy loves Kulk. And Deckel's like, no, you're just out of place. I think really Kulk does better on the director's cut than I think he does in the theatrical cut in terms of his relationship to Deckel.
Okay.
Because Deckel is shown as being too cautious. Like, he says unnecessary risk about flying in and then Aaliyah's kidnapped, right?
Yeah.
And later in the movie, in the director's cut, Kulk gives the, what, old 2005 or whatever it was, the artist self-destruct model.
Yes.
And so from that moment onward, there was a ticking clock. Like, that's a move that Kulk does that I don't think Deckel could ever do.
Yeah.
And the movie doesn't say that. Like, that's sort of something you have to intuit as an audience member.
Yeah, there's a number of moments where Deckard gives advice to Kirk, and he's almost always giving bad advice, frankly. He says we should raise shields, we should try to attack, we should arm our weapons, that we shouldn't get close to it. Like, he's constantly, and all of these things are just going to get them hit by a giant plasma torpedo. Yeah.
Well, see, the thing is like, Deco is, like, there's more to talk about with Deco than Ilea, because as A points out, Ilea is a plot device. Like, she's literally an object for the second half of the film.
Sure.
But with Deco, he creates, not only does he add to the tapestry of Track and Field, the sense that his lines are rewritten for Riker later on, and we can draw that parallel, but he also sets the precedent of the stupid Starfleet captain.
Okay.
And we're going to see that a lot in these films. Is they want to make Kirk look like a badass, so they make everyone around Kirk that's another captain incompetent. I'm thinking of Captain Stiles from Star Trek III, the arrogant guy with we're going to beat the Enterprise's speed record. And then Scotty says, up your shaft, and his ship breaks down, and he's kind of stuck there. Like, Star Trek does this in the movies that no other Trek does, which is showing these people of power incompetent to make Kirk look better. And it just makes him look less than.
And interestingly, in the original series, they do this with a bunch of Starfleet captains who've all gone bad.
Yeah.
Right? They're not stupid. They're turned into Nazis or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or it's the wayward admiral who, like, I've always had this little belief in Star Trek that once you hit the admiralty, like, something happens to you.
Yeah.
Like, it's like when the faculty member becomes an administrator, they've got 2 years, it's good, and everything else is fucking downhill. Like, you hit that 2-year admiralty bench, and then, like, something happens to you, and you just become part of the Bowl Collective, I don't know what it is,
you know,
and you decide you're going to become evil.
It's funny, because people, like, when Discovery came out, when it first arrived, a lot of fans were complaining, like, this is not my Star Trek. I'm like, what Star Trek have you been watching? Because Starfleet and the Federation are full of, like, stupid and incompetent Nazis.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, this is, like, Deco's legacy is, you're right. Like, he points out the bad advice so that Kirk can make the good decision. Like, that's the reason why we have the Prime Directive.
Yeah.
It's not because it's a moral way we look at the universe. It's because we want the captain to buck the system.
To break the rule,
to do the thing, to show character as opposed to setting forth a rule.
I'm going to sink into gaming nerddom here, and it reminds me of course, Ars Magica, one of my favorite games ever, where they have this Code of Hermes, this bunch of laws that all the wizards have to obey, and the Code of Hermes can be summed up as, thou shalt not do anything fun. Right? Because it means that the players are, of course, going to break the rules. So that's interesting view of the Prime Directive. Like, we set the Prime Directive that says you shall not do anything fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the captain breaks the Prime Directive because that's what the story is about. So the rule is created to be broken.
Yeah. And then justify your actions later. Like, I say, this is the first time Kirk saves planet Earth, and then as long as you save Earth, you're okay.
Yeah, history is written by the victors, right?
I'm guessing that just by watching it recently again, that Kirk and Decker get more screen time together than Kirk and Bones,
yeah,
and probably even Kirk and Spock. I mean, it's got to be getting that way. So that kind of relationship between the two is constantly played out throughout the entire thing. It's not just, you know, the odd conversation here and there. That is more, you know, but Bones barely gets a look in, poor old guy. You know, he gets to look at a few things and disappear and get rid of his beard. That's about it.
Bones is weird, because I'm watching this movie and I'm like, okay, the number of times that the turbo lift door opens to see Bones walk on the bridge, say nothing, and then 30 seconds later turn around and leave.
And then leaves.
What's going on here? Like, what are the writers doing? All right, so let's talk about the return of the cast. Spock, McCoy, Scotty, Uhura, Chekov, Sulu, and then even supporting cast from the original series like Rand and Chapel.
Yeah, Chapel, yeah.
What do we think? Does that work? Do we? What do we like about it? What do we not like?
I think Dr. Chapel is not good.
Tell me why.
Okay, so I understand, like okay, this also sets the thing in motion wherein, like, everyone becomes a captain on the Enterprise. Like we got Captain Scott, who's the captain of engineering. We got Spock as a captain. Like, everyone just gets promotions as the movies go on.
Yeah.
I think by having Dr. Chapel there, like, there was an interesting idea there. Like, when McCoy comes on and he goes, I hail Chapel's an MD now.
Yeah.
I need someone to take orders and not argue prescriptions or something like that.
Every diagnosis, yeah.
Yeah. Like, if we saw that, if that was a scene in the movie, set up, we get the conflict, and then we get a payoff of them together at the end on the bridge.
Like, they've got Ilya's body there, and they're arguing over what's going on inside Ilya's head. Right?
Yeah, like something, anything. But it's not. It's just, oh, she's a doctor now. But now McCoy has really nothing to do. Like, McCoy should be the one taking care of Chekhov on the bridge. But it's Dr. Chapel instead.
Roddenberry was sort of opposed to conflict between main characters. This is something that we learn about when Deep Space Nine is able to do a lot more of that conflict, because Roddenberry is more out of the picture, right?
Which is crazy, because you watch the original series and they're constantly butting heads.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Like, that's the whole point of the original series is like the crucible of ideas until we get whatever the solution is.
Interesting.
Like, whether that's just between McCoy and Spock, or whether that's in the conference room and Scotty chimes in and someone else chimes in. But it's constantly the synthesis of, okay, here's the problem. We have three different solutions.
Yeah.
And all of them suck.
Yeah, right.
Let's come up with a better solution. Let's come up with a thorn alternative.
Yeah.
And instead, it's like, by making that the rule, you wind up with this very sort of, I guess, passive approach to fiction.
Okay.
Passive approach to problem solving. Because I can have an idea that conflicts with Jason's idea, that conflicts with Aid's idea. And now none of us are necessarily wrong, but then we try to find out whatever the synthesis is of those three ideas, and that gives me drama.
Yeah.
Okay. Right? And I think that not having that sequence robs, like, it's nice that Major Barrett cashes a paycheck. It's nice that she's there.
Right.
I don't want to take her out of the movie. I want to give her something to do in the movie.
Yeah.
It's not just, I'm filling in the place of bones.
Or she's literally just spraying antibiotics on Chekhov's hand.
It's really a non-scene. Like, I want something more there to justify her place. Like, for me, it's not just a matter of, oh, this is a recurring character from the show. Let's have her here. Like, if she was distraught that Spock blew her off on the bridge.
Right.
If you're calling back to a mock time, yes, she needs to be there for that. But if we're not going to do that, then what's the point?
So I only watched it again like Thursday, Friday. So when Janice Rand shows up and the Nurse Chapel later on, it's like, correct, they actually got them back. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So, we've seen Picard, obviously, we're going all these callbacks. But I'm so glad that they actually reached out to him and said, okay, come back. Because the idea that even though we said Janice Rand doesn't say anything, at least she's there.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like you say, the idea of missed opportunities for those characters would be really nice as well. But yeah, at least they are there. And is this the last time we see both those characters? Or do they show up in later films? I don't know.
Janice Rand shows up, and Major Barrett also show up in every sort of, like, almost every movie.
Okay.
And that's really because of Leonard Nimoy. Like, Leonard Nimoy found out that the actress who does Janice Rand was unemployed and was like, no, we're making a movie. You're going to be in it.
Yeah.
And he would just railroad. Like, she shows up in Starfleet Command. It has no reason for her to be there, except for maybe Star Trek VI when she's on Sulu's bridge.
Of course, yes, of course. This, like I was saying last week about the idea that this is the slow Trek. This is what I tend to avoid watching. So I've watched classic original series Trek since this. I've probably not seen this for God knows how long. And watching it now, it's like, oh my God, there's actually a lot more references than I realized. So the original series, this is really good. Yeah.
All right. So how about, we talked about Spock a lot last week about how he's the only character that really has anything like a real arc in this picture. He starts off as a character who's trying to pursue total logic, but by the end of the film has acknowledged that that's not the way to live, right? Like he has this, when he mind melds with V'ger and then we see him in sick bay, he has this wonderful scene where he explains, well, where he grabs Kirk by the arm, right? And and he's almost smiling. You can tell, like Nimoy is like trying not to smile. I want to smile, but not smile. And he says, this simple human feeling is something that V'ger can't understand. And it's really where he's broken out of that pure logic that he starts off, the position he starts off at the beginning of the picture. And by the end of the picture, he seems to have kind of put all that behind him, and he's back to basically being the Spock that we have always loved. But he's the only character that really gets that. McCoy, yeah, he's funny and he's smart whenever he's on the show, and DeForest Kelly's wonderful at that character. But like so many other characters, he's terribly underutilized, isn't he?
Yeah. Bones is my favorite character of the three. So anytime Bones is on anything, like it's like, okay, this is great. But yeah, but I don't know. First of all, why does Bones keep leaving Starfleet every time? It seems like every movie is like, I'm coming back. Okay, yeah. Right. The scene where they pick him up again is not the scene I was originally thinking of. So when he just shows up at in the transporter with a big beard on, I was like, okay, this is not the one I remember. But okay, carry on.
And it's like '70s big gold '70s medallion.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's so weird. But yeah, but Bones, I love Bones. Bones is just such a cool character. And again, it's a strange relationship he also still maintains with Spock. They're still butting heads. They're still kind of, you know, ripping into each other.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's great. It's nice to have that back, if nothing else.
Tim, what do you think about Bones in this film?
Well, Aid said, Bones is my favorite of the three. I mean, it's a close horse race, but it's Bones, Cork, and Spock. I mean, that's just, and they're like hail breaths.
Right,
and some days of the week, if you get me in a different mood, I'm those answers change, but they're always like really close to each other. Bones is underutilized, as he's going to be underutilized in all of his movies, with the exception of Star Trek III.
Yes, right, where he's key to the plot.
Three, he gets to do something.
Yeah, he's the MacGuffin,
and I think with sort of with three through five, I think more the supporting actors at least get a scene.
Yes.
Where they get to do something. Like Sulu gets a scene, Chekhov gets his moment. Like even if they're sharing the moment, like Scotty and Uhura in Star Trek V, they at least get scenes together.
That's right.
Well, not plot heavy scenes.
Yep.
Well, they're not solving a function and they feel like people. But unfortunately, Bones, like, we think of the Holy Trinity as Colt, Spock, and McCoy, but when they relaunched this in 2009, it's a Horus picture, not Bones' picture on the poster. Yeah.
That's right. That's
right. Like Bones is written out of those movies almost entirely, to the point where he is serving a similar function to the way he's functioning in the motion picture. Well, he's there as support or ancillary material for Colt.
And it's such a shame too, because Carl Urban does such a great Bones. I love his Bones.
Yeah, he's like everyone in that cast is really good, but Bones is just spot on. But you know, I feel like it's the same for Uhura. Like she gets, like you say, Culp takes over her job at one point.
Yeah.
She's told twice to turn off the monitor before she does it. Chekhov gets hurt. And he's the weapons officer, so I guess that's a promotion. That's a lateral promotion. Sulu's just there. I mean, I'm glad these people are here, but they're not. They don't feel to me as authentic as they do in any random episode of Trek.
Yeah, they don't contribute. They, if you go for classic Trek, even though generally speaking we'd have most of the episodes revolve around the three core characters, there are at least one handful of episodes where McCoy would do where Uhura would do something, where Sulu would be the focus of this, or Chekhov, all that kind of stuff. Chekhov was normally the young crew man who just got just tried to get away with as much as possible kind of thing. So, but you know, we've seen like a few odds and sods. But I know watching over there. Oh, and of course Scotty now.
Yeah.
Now, Scotty. Now,
let's talk about Scotty.
Scotty runs a second to McCoy for my character and folks, yeah. But the motion picture introduces the iconic version of Scotty. The moustache, slightly graying hair Scotty is more Scotty than original series Scotty.
I agree with you. Yeah,
yeah, I love it. I just love the look of him. He just seems to have grown into that part so much.
When I think about when I think of like Uhura, for example, or even Kirk, I think of their original series versions.
Yep.
But when I think of Scotty, I think of slightly portly,
yeah,
graying Scotty from the films. And
he has a vest on to hide some of that porn.
A vest on, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, he's such a wonder. I actually met him once at a Star Trek convention when I was a much younger person. And you're right. Why is the Scotty in the films better than the Scotty in the original series?
I just think he's got a look. In classic Trek, he looks like everybody else. He looks like it's just the guy. He's just the guy in the uniform. He could be anybody. Whereas this one's like, he's the guy with the moustache. He's different. From yeah.
Well, while I think the look is definitely a lot of it.
Yeah.
I think it's also because this is the Scotty that's parodied.
Oh,
that's true.
William Shatner's Kirk is parodied by Eddie Murphy from the TV show. So that's sort of like the iconic representation of Kirk as a ladies' man, even though the text does not necessarily support that all the time.
Right.
So the idea is like this is the classic Jimmy Doohan Scotty that is referenced in anything. Like if you do a Beam Me Up Scotty, you're not doing classic Trek. You're doing Scotty from the films.
That's
you're
true.
Doing Bolty, like The Simpsons. He can't reach the controls, or even Jimmy Doohan parodied it in Loaded Weapon 1 when he shows up and he can't fix the coffee pot. Right? Talks to the captain, I'm giving her all she's got. But that's Scotty with the mustache and the vest and the brogue.
Yeah,
like that's classic Scotty.
Yeah.
And I think time has been kinder to him than some of the other people when you take into consideration all the health problems he had in his life.
Okay.
Because he nearly died after the motion picture.
Duane,
the actor. That's why there was a line in Wrath of Khan saying that McCoy helped me through a spot of shore leave.
Yeah.
It's because he had health problems. He had Parkinson's disease, fibiosis caused by chemicals he was exposed to in World War II.
Really?
Yeah, he's. It's amazing he lived as long as he did, considering the life that he lived. Because he was, you know, he was on D-Day. He lost his finger in the war. Like Doohan's a badass.
Yeah.
Like, I love the man. Like he's just awesome people.
So one of the things that I was struck by as I was watching this is the recurring language about kneading. Kirk starts this when he first sees Bones and he says, I need you. And of course, all of the slash fiction writers immediately go bananas at this kind of language, right? Because I need you. And then he says, badly, like I need you badly. And then there's a similar moment when Spock shows up on the bridge, but he doesn't say it to Spock. He says it again to McCoy, referring to Spock in the third person. Like we need him. And I thought that was the end of it. But then when I rewatched the picture, it came back when Spock is talking about V'ger, and V'ger also has a need, right? V'ger needs something. But as Spock has come to understand after his mind melt, but V'ger doesn't understand what it needs. And this is compared to the human experience. This is all of us. We all need something, but we don't understand all of the time what it is that we need. And I found this interesting because it set up Kirk in contrast to V'ger. Kirk and V'ger both need things. But what makes Kirk superior, what makes Kirk the hero, is that he knows what he needs, and V'ger doesn't. And so it becomes a sort of educational story about somebody who's more aware of themselves. And this is what the movie's arguing. I'm not saying it's successful, that Kirk is more aware of what he needs, and he helps V'ger to also become aware of what he needs.
So I have a counterpoint.
Okay, good. Yeah.
All right. So my counterpoint is, yes, the film is saying that, but they're not connecting the dots.
Yeah, I think you're obviously right.
You have a constellation that would work. Like, if we were remaking Star Trek the motion picture and we were three guys and we were sitting down breaking down, I'd be like, throw that in the text. Like,
yeah,
that's when Bones comes in and he says the thing and he points it out. And then Kulk gets a new understanding of the problem.
Yeah.
I think that is not fully addressed until Wrath of Khan, when Spock comments that, you know, being a starship captain was his one best, you know, his true best destiny, and anything else is a waste of material.
Yeah.
Like, that's sort of like he's getting lost in all the material that he has to deal with as an admiral. Like, he accepted this promotion, and we're kind of left wondering, as an audience, we're left wondering, why do you accept the promotion?
Yeah.
You're not good at it. It's not what you want to do. Was it a pay grade? Like, it's not a pay raise. Like, we know that money works differently in the 23rd century. Like, so that is never explained in the films, and I sort of wish it was.
It would be a great thing for us to find out. It's like, why? I mean, I'm sure some writers have written it. There's probably multiple different answers to this question, depending on where it was written. But I would love to see, was it because he got an offer from someone to settle down? And he thought, well, maybe it's time. Maybe this is the career path for a captain. This is what they do.
Well, that's where the interesting part of that is, like, that's where Generations flashback to Antonio comes in. Because Antonio is supposed to be sometime between motion picture and Wrath of Khan. That's not clarified in the text. But the way it sort of works out in the timeline is that happens somewhere between these two films.
And we will get to Star Trek VI, or we'll get to Star Trek Generations eventually.
That's going to have to be a two-parter.
Yeah. Aid, what do you think about all of this? Am I full of shit?
No, I think you're right. I think it's a good parallel between the two kind of characters. I find it fascinating that Kirk seems to have changed. His character seems to have evolved. I honestly can't see Kirk making that same kind of speech in the classic series. He may kind of allude to it, but the idea he actually says it out loud seems to be very un-Kirk-like. So something bad must have happened over those last couple of years where he just says, yeah, I need to tell people what's going on. Yeah, yeah.
The most Kirk-like moment in this whole movie for me is when he says to Spock, will you please sit down? Which is so totally William Shatner, like, being funny. Right. But I don't think he would have had this language about needing in the original series. He's more open with his feelings, at least to Bones and only to Bones. I just find it so weird that he can say to Bones, I need you, but he can't say to Spock, I need you. He has to say, we need him to Bones.
Kirk being the kind of like the renegade, as it were, as opposed to Picard's, you know, technically by the book stuff. He always had a more emotional approach to problem solving in that respect. Yeah. It's like, this feels right, but the idea he would literally just say, well, you know, I need you, they need to, this needs to happen kind of thing, just seems very not Kirk-y.
All right, so how about V'ger? Let's talk about the antagonist, because for the most of the movie, V'ger is the antagonist, and it starts off as a cloud. And then it's a probe in a very short scene, but which was very memorable to me as a kid. Like, I remember that thing. And they did weird camera tricks, like freezing people's motions, and the way that Ilea gets kind of manipulated by the probe was very creepy. And then it's embodied as Ilea, which is a probe from V'ger, but becomes sort of the voice of V'ger, the mouth of V'ger, if you will. And then finally we find the actual Voyager probe itself, which, as I mentioned, was very much on all of our minds back in the 70s because it had just passed Jupiter a few months before the movie came out. And that scene in the beginning of the movie when they fly out of the solar system on the Enterprise and they had this big flyby of Jupiter with all of its moons – like, that was a distinct callback to the Voyager images. And it's actually setting up Voyager's appearance at the end of the movie. That shot of Jupiter and its moons is the first call forward to V'ger's appearance and at his actual identity at the end of the movie. But what do we think of V'ger? How does it work?
Right.
Right.
Right. Okay, so first of all, let's go. I'll approach this from some of the effect. We've been saying we're going to talk about the special effects. First of all, the sense of scale in this is brilliant. Though that first shot where you see the Enterprise kind of when it actually goes there and you see it kind of superimposed against kind of that bluey kind of side, it feels big. It's really, really well done in that respect.
Yeah.
And then it goes really weird because like we're saying about.
The technical displays help because we see like these enormous clouds and this tiny little Enterprise with an arrow pointing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then it starts getting kind of almost kind of like more metaphysical rather than kind of like I think we get used to seeing holographic images and it's got this, it's got that, it's got the all of the information as a holographic database kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, this kind of reminds me of Magrathea in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it's just like a vast, they're building Earth, and it's just like, you can't see the edges of the thing. It reminds me of that. It's just like blackness with stuff.
I was thinking of Hitchhiker's Guide as well. Like, we've recorded everything we've ever experienced in here, yeah.
It's a shame, because I would have liked to have seen more of that kind of epic scale stuff in it. The idea, even in Forbidden Planet, where they go inside the machine and then you look down into that vast abyss of all those machinery going on there. Something like that would have been so good, just the daunting scale of it. And like the one bit that brings that back again is when they actually land the Enterprise and everybody gets out of on the saucer section. Again, that kind of actually gives some sense of scale to this thing. It's really good. It's just a shame it's all just blackness and darkness. And obviously, then when we get to see the probe, it's effectively a soundstage with more blackness around the outside of it. It's a shame in that respect.
Yeah, Jim.
Well.
Are we going to talk about how thirsty this movie is? Are we going to talk about how thirsty this movie is?
This movie is very thirsty. The movie is dehydrated, and it desperately wants to get laid.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, all of Vigil's architecture is very emblematic of sex imagery.
Yeah, yeah.
To the point where it's a little embarrassing.
Last week, when you mentioned that part of V'ger's interior looks like ovaries, and I was rewatching it today, and now I cannot unsee that.
You can't. Like, it's so
boobs, and it's like forbidden. Like, what's the mission where the sci-fi movie where they go down inside the human body? They get shrunk down into
inner space.
Oh, Fantastic Voyage. Fantastic
Voyage. Yeah.
Basically, the Enterprise is the ship in Fantastic Voyage.
Yeah.
That's a design choice as well. That's just, that hasn't happened by accident. They go, it looks a bit like it. Someone's actually gone out and made those things.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And they spent a lot of money on it.
They did.
And I know it's unfair to say the motion picture is super expensive because the movie itself isn't. It's all the pre-production for phase two and the other types of projects that ultimately became that's the downside to Brian Singer's Superman, right? Like, it's not just the film itself and the marketing for said film. It's the 20 years of production that got rolled onto the budget sheets of that film.
Yes, yes. About half of the motion picture's budget was really 20 years of pre-production.
Like we said, they scrapped the uniforms. Like, whatever their initial uniforms were, they threw those out the airlock. So someone spent money to make ovaries and thigh structures and anus-looking orifices that slowly open and close. Like, it's a really horny movie, is what I'm trying to say. It literally, the whole visual plot thread, if we want to be as base as possible, it requires a man, a physical man and love interest, to fix the plot.
Yeah.
Like, it needs something. It needs a man to integrate with it, to mold with it, to become and to give birth to a new life form.
That's right. Yeah, McCoy talks about delivering a baby at the end.
Yeah. So it's a very horny movie. And it's very embarrassing to watch at times when you're like, oh, these are clearly supposed to be ovaries, and the Enterprise is inseminating itself right through them.
And it even happens at the very beginning with the Klingons, because when we see the Klingons, there's this huge, the camera focuses on the front of the D7 as this big phallic image aimed right at V'ger, and then it rotates around this big flying dick shape.
Right? It does.
Yeah, and then of course we have Ilya. I keep saying Ilya, but it's Ilya. She's recreated naked in the shower. It's not
good. There's no way to get around it.
Yeah,
and once you have it pointed out to you, you can never unsee it.
Yeah,
like I was blissfully unaware of it until, you know, maybe 15 years ago when I was rewatching, going, wait a minute.
I blame you.
Why is this making me feel this way? This is not appropriate for Star Trek, and I am uncomfortable.
All right, so the theatrical cut was essentially an unfinished picture.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of apocryphal stories of the film being carried to the premiere, literally like wet from the film process still. It had not been properly edited. And so many years later, when was the director's cut?
So the director's cut was commissioned by Paramount in 2001 to come out with the six movie DVD set.
That's right.
Yeah. Because up until that point, the very first DVDs that they released was Nemesis, and because that was a new movie when that came out, and Star Trek II. And then they piecemealed the rest of the series throughout, you know, like a 6 month to 12 month program. And they never went to the motion picture. So the clamor was, where's the motion picture? And they finally talked Robert Wise to coming back to do his director's cut with the promise that he had complete say.
Okay.
And that's when we get the special effects. And the people who are working on the TV show at the time, you know, of Deep Space Nine and Voyager and Enterprise, they come in to sort of help massage it back into canon. So Vulcan looks like Vulcan in the director's cut, as opposed to weird alien planet with 17 moons when we know Vulcan has no moons.
Right.
The thing that strikes me about the director's cut is that it doesn't change the narrative. Like, it doesn't really do much. It writes in the margins, you know, in the periphery, if you will. But what it does is it takes its time to give you context for things. So in the theatrical cut, when Kirk shouts out, you know, on screen, and you see a map, you just see the map. Now you see the map, but it's over Kirk's shoulder.
Yeah.
And it's just like these subtle things that be like, hey, humans are involved in this. It's not a whole bunch of alien things being looked at by humans. It's now being interactive in a way.
There's this great shot of when he and Scotty are on the shuttle touring the Enterprise before he boards it. And for one thing, they trimmed that whole scene down, so it's much shorter. But there's this, in the original, we just see Kirk giving a reaction shot, basically looking, you know, above the camera somewhere. But in the new shot, the Enterprise is reflected in the glass of the shuttle. So Kirk, but we also see what he's looking at as we see him. And it's just so much smarter.
Yeah. And those are a lot of little touches like that. Like the conference room scene has one of the nacelles in the background through the window. When they explode the asteroid, it pulls out to a camera shot to show the Enterprise in the foreground, in the middle ground, the asteroid in the background, and then the explosion happens. So you get like just these little things that, you know, these people now know how to tell a Star Trek story, right? We've had, at that point, we had X number 40 years of Star Trek narrative. We now know how to tell it in a way that audiences expect it to be told. So whereas you can get away with an infographic on, say, a HAL 2001 Space Odyssey movie, that's not going to fly in a movie that's supposed to be about the human adventure and people interacting with the unknown.
Hey, what do you think? Director's cut?
I honestly don't know if I've seen the director's cut.
Oh, really?
Now you mentioned, I mean, you mentioned a lot of stuff that's subtle, so there is a possibility I have seen it, but I just don't remember it. But I'm surprised, again, like we were saying about the idea of the sense of scale and Voyager and all these and the actual background, I'm surprised they didn't chuck a load more stuff in it.
Oh, yeah.
When they do this with, like, I mean, they do this with classic Doctor Who episodes. They kind of, like, redo all these effect shots into CGI versions, that kind of stuff. And 95% of the time, it's just like, oh, okay, we'll make it look better. We won't change too much. Sometimes they will put extra backgrounds in, or if you go to full Lucas, we'll say extra Jubaks and Stormtroopers.
Yeah,
I'm surprised they didn't just say, right, let's make this look really big. We'll put sense of scale in. Everywhere there's sense of scale rather than just darkness.
Well, I really recommend it because I just watched it today, and it's a much better film. I mean, yeah, a lot of the bits are relatively minor, but from the very first minute, it's a better movie. And I'll give you an example, because if you remember last week, we were talking about how I was watching the theatrical release, and I thought that there was something wrong with my set because I was hearing music, but the screen was black. Well, in the director's cut, they put a Starfield up. So you hear the music, but you know that, okay, it's supposed to be like that, right?
This is what I got. I watched it again, like I said, this week, and I had obviously the same thing, just blackness. And I'm thinking, how did this go on TV? You're telling me they had a black screen just on when it's actually on terrestrial television? And they just said, just watch this black screen for a minute and a half. You'll be fine. Everyone must be complaining on the TV, on the telephone.
Hey, did you watch the Blu-ray?
Yes.
Okay, so the Blu-ray is the theatrical cut.
That's what I thought. Yes.
Okay. Now, but the most important cut to me, and this is, I think, Jim, you alluded to this last week, but when I rewatched it, is this scene in which Spock weeps for V'ger. And it's been cut completely. So it's still, you haven't seen it.
But it's
right near the end. It's right before they end up stepping out onto the saucer section. And they notice that Spock is crying, and he explains that he's crying for V'ger, and he says there's a moment in everybody's life where you reach out to someone, a brother or a father, and he's calling back to those moments where he grabbed Kirk, right? Physically, where you reach out to someone. And that moment where Kirk reaches out to McCoy and says, I need you badly. There's these moments where we all do this. We reach out to someone and we ask, is this all there is? Is there more to life than this? Why are we here? What is my purpose, right? And V'ger doesn't know its purpose. It can't do that. It's trying, but it's incredibly immature in the way that it's trying to do it. This is important to me because it is, in many cases, it's the most important moment of the picture. I honestly cannot believe they cut it.
Yeah.
There's a theory of narrative called the six narrative steps. It was invented by described by a guy named Labov, and I've used it in classes many times. But his basic argument is that every story has sort of six steps that the story goes through. And I won't walk through all of them now because it will bore the snot out of you. But the fourth step is evaluation. There's a moment in the story where you explain to the people listening to the story why they should be listening to the story. Like, what is the story about? What is the thing that you're carrying away? And this can be really simple. It can be like, and that's why I swore I'm never going to drink again or whatever. Like, whatever your moral, and I want to use that word moral because it's more complicated than that. It's the takeaway, like the thing that the story is about. This is that moment. This is the moment when the movie, through Spock, tells you what the movie is about. This movie is about how we all reach out for someone. And that's all that V'ger is doing. V'ger is experiencing a very human lack, and it needs human contact. Why? Because it wants to know that there's more going on in the universe than itself, right? Like, there must be more to life than this. And this is a classic Roddenberry move because it's essentially an anti-religious move. It's an atheistic move. And I guess that maybe they felt like there were other moments in the movie that explained that already enough. But I was shocked when I heard Spock explain the movie to us and then realized that was left on the cutting room floor.
Strange. Because again,
I just don't think they knew what the movie was. Like, I honestly just don't think they knew, because like the thing is like we write stories, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you're a game developer like Aid or you write a narrative and you write and you go into it and you think you know what the story is, at least the story that you're trying to tell.
Yeah.
And that story is going to change between every playing group that takes it.
Right. That's right. In fact, in many ways, the true meaning of the story is what the table decides it means.
Yeah. And you have no say over that. You have no control over that.
But this is not.
I understand that in a very small scale. Now, imagine writing a movie.
Yeah.
A big budget movie. You're being paid $1 million a week, and you're trying to draft something and bring something, and you're not a Star Trek fan. You don't really know what this thing's about.
Yeah.
And you're just throwing ideas out. And then now you have to cut the movie, and the writer's not in the room, and you're cutting this movie, and you're like, okay, this movie's about a giant sex object that needs to get laid, or this movie's about people reconnecting, or this movie's about contact, or this movie's like, and then once you start editing the movie down, you lose like whatever the writer's intent is.
They probably just cut it because they felt that it was slowing down the ending.
Yeah, which is mind-boggling because the movie has been walking at such a leisurely pace to begin with.
Yeah.
Because they also cut off the ticking clock.
You're right. Yeah, there's this wonderful scene where Kirk calls up Scotty and says, get ready to blow up the ship. Mm-hmm. It's one of the very rare lines for a minor cast member. There's a woman in engineering, and I don't even know her name. And she asks Scotty, why is the captain giving the self-destruct order? And Scotty has to explain, yes, if the Enterprise blows up in the middle of Viger, it will save the Earth, but it will take everybody with it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it's a moment where a new character gets a line. Mm-hmm. Random doesn't get a line. Chapel doesn't get a line. But random engineer, you know, Ensign gets a line.
And that may have been why that line was cut.
Maybe, but it is.
People, the politicking, like you can't look at these films and not go into the politics of how they were made. Because there's so much political intrigue going on in terms of, my character won't ever do this.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but you're not giving the creative, replacement for that. You're just saying no.
There's a lot of egos in that room.
There's a lot of egos. And I think like this is the film where all the egos are very tender and very sore because they just had a decade of being typecast as these people. And they're coming back for the first time as those very same people on a much larger scale. Yeah. So I think that's why Colt can't. Like William Shatner can't be in the wrong. Which is so real.
It's a terrible script idea. Like to write a script where your main character can do nothing wrong. Do you remember when Mark Waid was talking about writing Superman in Kingdom Come? Mm-hmm. And he was like, my Superman never makes a wrong decision. And he got pilloried for that. Like they gave him hell for that. Mm-hmm. But if you read All-Star Superman, that's exactly what Morrison's Superman is. Morrison's Superman is always right, and he makes it work because Morrison's a master storyteller. That's really hard to do.
I, again, watching this through, I'm surprised how much of the actual movie is effectively a bottle show. It's the classic, we've got no budget, and the irony being it's really, really expensive. But it's... When they wrote it, again, because we compared it to like Close Encounters and 2001, it seems to be they've missed out. We've not got any alien planets as such. We've not even got a Kirk fist fight, for Christ's sake. That's the crazy thing. We've not got any laser battles or starship battles. It's such a weird way that this is what they settled on. I was just surprised how much of the we paid for this set, we're damn well using it. It's like So yeah, it's a strange movie.
I remember
compare it to like the first 5 minutes of Star Trek II. We're already on an alien planet. We're already shooting through space. We've got people going on. There's a starship battle later on. We're throwing everything at the wall this time. It's such a weird one.
Well, remember Star Trek II literally opens with killing off the whole cast.
Yeah.
in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, it's great. I remember when this film came out, as kids, as fans, I was struck with the fact that we don't know what phasers look like. Like they never fire the phasers.
Yeah.
They fire the photon torpedoes, and we notice that the Federation photon torpedoes are a different color than the Klingon photon torpedoes. But what do phasers look like? Why can't you have a Star Trek movie without firing the phasers? I mean, what kind of movie is this? As the 11-year-old was very disappointed.
That's why it's so strange. It's like literally making a Star Wars movie, and everybody just stays on the same planet and, you know, plays cards or something. It's such a weird thing.
It's not just that. Like, you can have a Star Trek movie where no one fires phasers. It's called Star Trek IV.
But that's true, yes.
The way you approach the matter, because Star Trek IV is all about the people trying to solve the problem. And they're working together, and they're all out of their element. They're all essentially Spock in that movie because they're all fish out of water. And they're doing the best they can to get by and to solve these problems that keep coming up. But it's ultimately about the people. This movie isn't about Spock or McCoy as much as we want to make it that.
Yeah.
This movie is ultimately about Vigil, which is not a person.
Right? Yeah, and obviously Star Trek IV and this have got incredibly parallel storylines anyway. The idea is it's a big thing. It's going to blow Earth up. Okay, let's solve the problem. Yeah, it's the same kind of thing.
As I was watching this film, I was struck by one last game mechanic thing. Like, Spock's character sheet has an ability where he can call a huddle. This happens at least 3 times in the movie where the whole plot freezes while Spock says, "Captain," and walks off to the side of the set. Everybody else converges on him, and they have a conversation that the villain cannot overhear, even though he is literally 5 feet away on the same set.
you gotta save those fate points. Those fate points didn't happen.
He's got a power, and he got okay. So Kirk, McCoy, Scott, they all stand together. Decker stands there, and then they basically just bullshit the problem together, and they expose what they're going to do, and then not only is it private, but they have all the time they need to do it. Like, PCs, players would kill for this ability to, like, you know, it would drag down your plot, would slow your game to a crawl. But anyway, it's just so funny. Like, they literally do this on the bridge, and they do it on Vigil, like, in the front of Vigil. Like, they're facing the probe, and Spock's like, "Captain," and he walks off to the side.
Well, see, what you have to do is you have to use stage whispers. Stage whispering can beat a telepathic probe.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
That's just like the rock, sizzles, papal of Star Trek.
So how do the special effects stand up in this film? We've talked about them a little bit already. Abe, what do you think?
So I like the special effects.
Yeah.
They look 70s special effects. You can tell, compare this to 2001, the actual kind of the way you can say, okay, they're not up to modern standards, but the actual design choices they've made for the starships, they're really good. They stand up. I mean, the Enterprise refit doesn't kind of look, oh, it's that crappy Enterprise one they brought out in the movie. It's a really good design, and it's iconic.
I agree. It really is a beautiful design.
So, the space station and all that kind of stuff. So when the kind of like the lightning goes over the space station right near the beginning, you can say, okay, it's whatever superimposed. It's an old effect, but the actual design of the station looks really good, and it determined as flashing light sci-fi, where you just have like banks of computers in the background that just flash lights. It doesn't really do that. They've kind of gone to like a more serious version of science fiction, and stuff looks really good. Yeah. But it's nice. And again, the idea of all that stuff they did for Vija, the actual kind of journey through.
Yeah,
that must be all pretty much hand drawn. I mean, again, going back to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy TV series, the book stuff is all hand-drawn, one single letter each time added to the actual script. This must be something similar to that.
There's some ink tank work, I think, in this picture. And this is back when we had models instead of CGI, right? So there's a lot of that work as well. Jim, what do you think about the special effects? Hold up.
I'm not a special effects guy.
Yeah.
So for me, like, I prefer watching my original series with the models and the lights.
Yeah.
Because like any special effect is going to be dated in 5 years or 10 years.
Yeah.
The advent of computers and how fast everything accelerates. What matters to me are the human moments.
Yeah.
All it's the little character bits that happen in a film that I can go back. Like I want to rewatch Khan to be in the room with Kirk and Spock and the Sparklets decoration all have an argument as to whether or not Kirk should have become admiral. Like those are things that I care about. Like all the special effects in the world, they can be flashy now, but they are going to look cheap in 10, 15, 20 years down the road.
Well, you're going to get your Star Trek 2 wish next week.
Yeah.
I have the same, again, being a Doctor Who fan, I can just appreciate for what they're going for rather than what it looks like.
Yeah.
So the idea is like, okay, Tom Baker stuff, some of the stuff look ropey, the giant robot in his first episode. Yeah, okay, you can see it's a blue screen. I think we're crap. It's fine. It's great. And they're trying. That's all that matters. And I think they're doing a good job with this. So.
They get an A for effort.
Yeah, exactly.
And that counts for a lot. I mean,
it does count for a lot. Now, I really want to give Jim some beef here on your insistence that V'ger is not a person, because of course the whole point of the movie is that V'ger has the same problems and needs and desires as everybody else. He's just a child and doesn't understand them. But your larger point is true, right? Like it's about these actors and these characters that they've created for us. And we're not invested in V'ger, but we're totally invested in Kirk, Spock, McCoy and Scotty and the rest. And it's in many ways, it's a shame. A lot of opportunities got missed in this picture, which they tried to address with the director's cut. And in some ways, I think they did the best they could with what they had, but it exposes a lot of the production challenges of a project like this, when there's a lot of egos involved and a lot of time has passed, a lot of water's under the bridge, and you have to not only tell a good story, you have to do that whole relaunch, the whole franchise problem, and launching the ship and introducing new characters. And this movie had to carry a lot of water. And it's not perfect, but
my wife chimed in, it's bloated enough.
Well, fair enough. On that note, we'll give Misty the final word and move on to, so next week we're going to start with Wrath of Khan, which is in many people's opinion the best Star Trek film. I think that's fair to say that it is the popular winner for best Star Trek movie. I know Jim doesn't agree.
No. I do agree with that assessment that it's the best. It's not my favorite, and there was a distinction.
Ah, okay. Well, we'll explore this next week.
I'll explore it in like six episodes from now.
Okay. Abe?
Yeah, I agree. I do like it, but it's definitely not my favorite of the classic stuff.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. All right. Well, so if you want to watch with us, some of us are going to watch the director's cut. I have the director's cut, like special edition. Which I think I last watched on the anniversary of Nimoy's death, you know, like, cause I'm that nerd. But I'm going to watch it again, but others of us have only watched the theatrical cut, and that's what they want to see, cause that's what they first saw in the movie theater or whatever. So we'll both watch different versions of the show and compare them. And if you have, Jim.
Should we try to rate motion picture? I mean, we sort of told, like, when we did the call, we were like, did we like the episode, yay or nay? Like, do we even like this movie, guys?
Oh, are we talking motion picture?
Yeah, in the motion picture. Like I know you're segueing to
yeah, that's all right,
get us out, but I just kind of think, like,
well,
that seems to be part of the discussion that's lost, because we've made it very academic.
Well, what do you think? So you started this. Do you like it?
I sort of like it for what it could have been, but I don't like the actual finished product.
Okay. Abe?
Yeah. Again, it's always one. If someone says watch all six movies, this would be the one I'd be reluctant to watch again.
I actually kind of sat here and went, could I bullshit my way through it?
Yeah. Because again, it's just like, okay, I mean, again, I said before, it's the slow plodding one. It actually wasn't as bad as I remember it being. And again, I think it's because when I always reference it to being, you know, more Star Warsy, you know, epic stuff going on, you know, stuff blowing up,
Yeah.
And again, there's some really good stuff in it that if we didn't have this, we probably wouldn't have had. Like I said before, the engineering uniforms, I love those. We've got, you know, mustachioed Scotty. It's all good in that respect. So, but yeah, given the choice, Star Trek kind of just starts with Star Trek 2 most of the time if I got a choice. So, yeah. But well, yeah,
I enjoyed the film. I enjoyed the director's cut more. I definitely recommend if anyone's looking to rewatch or looking for a way to spend a good 2 hours, 2.25 hours, watch the director's cut. It's not a bad picture. I enjoyed it. It's not perfect. It's got some flaws, but you know, it's easier for us to criticize it in hindsight when we're not.
And I know some people, this is my dad's favorite Star Trek movie.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah.
Like I know some people who like live and die this movie.
It is very quintessential Star Trek. I mean, if we're talking about what is Star Trek about,
yeah,
it's
more classic. It's more classic. Again, this we're going to mention earlier on when we said about this one being the one without the fist fights and the spaceships and stuff.
Yeah. Star Trek II is Horatio Hornblower in space, which is super great and I love it, but it's actually not very Star Trek.
No. And that's the thing. It's kind of there is an escalation of action throughout the classic treks, especially. But even by the time you reach Nemesis, where stuff's exploding every 5 seconds, there is a lot more going on in that respect. There's more more spaceship battles as we go through. There's more all this kind of stuff is happening. The bigger the number, the more explosions, effectively.
All right, gang, we'll come back. Join us again next week. Watch your Star Trek 2 so you can follow along or listen to us and then go watch it afterwards. But we'll be here anyway. And thanks again for watching, and we'll see you next week.